It was a special pleasure this morning to be on the platform with Mrs. Wakefield, the announcer, whom I have known for many years. I notice she has made her escape to the balcony already. Apparently, she does not share the paternal yearning for the limelight. Last week, we talked about the concept of heaven and how the images used in Christian scripture to describe what heaven is like were all determined by the culture out of which the writers came. That sermon, like all the rest, is on tape, so that if you are visiting this morning and you wish to catch up with this brief series on the afterlife, we'd be very pleased to lend you a copy. This morning, I'd like to demonstrate that the pictures used to describe hell originated in the same way. But I need to say something else first about both ideas, and this surprises many people. We tend to think that heaven and hell are ideas as old as the Bible itself. But the truth is that through most of the Jewish history shown in the Bible, in the Old Testament, no one believed in such places. It takes a course in the Bible to prove it, and we can't squeeze one into 20 minutes, but it is a fact that the early centuries of Jewish scripture give no hint of faith in a life after death. So the first thing to say this morning is that the doctrine of eternal punishment, the idea of hell, did not exist in that scripture. That it evolved much later, and that unless you take the view that the book of Revelation is the stopping place, there is plenty of evidence that it is still evolving. Most Christians simply take it for granted that the Bible shows God making hell about the same time he made everything else, so that it would be ready for the majority of the human race, who, they tell us, he knew in advance would qualify to live in it. That's how Milton pictures it in his famous poem, and that's how many preachers proclaim it. So the idea is well entrenched. But the concept of hell is one more of those countless things in human life that evolved rather than sprang full-blown into existence. If it would help to have this remark backed up by other people using more formal language, here's a quote from the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible, probably the most scholarly work of its kind in general use. Nowhere in the Old Testament is the abode of the dead regarded as a place of punishment or torment. The concept of an infernal hell developed in Israel only during the Hellenistic period, the Greek period, probably under the influence of Iranian ideas. The Hellenistic period includes the 3 centuries before Christ came. After most of the Old Testament books had already been written, you may find it ironic that the Iranians get credit for having given us hell. And now, some 2,000 years later, some of them are still doing it. This period of 2 or 3 centuries before Christ is the period between the Testaments. That's why you can finish the last book of the Old Testament without a single clear reference to hell as Christians speak of it. And yet when you open the first New Testament book, Matthew, You are in a world where hell is taken for granted. It would bore you to hear me try to trace that evolving concept of hell as it came to the Jewish people through Persian or Iranian influence and then was passed on to Christianity. But there are books that do it, if you decide to read them. The most important thing to remember this morning is that such ideas all tend to be culturally determined. In any society, the place of punishment in the afterlife will take on the forms which are familiar in that society. People think about what they fear most in the world they know, project those fears into the afterlife, and what they project becomes the landscape of hell. No one summed it up any better than Omar Khayyam in the Rubaiyat. Listen carefully. I sent my soul through the invisible, some letter of the afterlife to spell. And by my soul returned to me and answered, I myself am heaven and hell. Heaven, but the vision of fulfilled desire. Hell, the shadow of a soul on fire. Project your own longings and your own fears, and you have the images of heaven and hell. Let's see how it worked among the people of Christ's time. Mark 9 speaks of hell as a place where the devouring worm never dies, and the fire is not quenched. And a parable in Matthew 22 speaks of hell as a place of outer darkness. Worms, fire, and darkness. Where do images like that come from? Because they have to come from somewhere. If they come out of the culture the writer knows, then it should be possible to trace them. Let's see if we can do it. The word used in the New Testament to describe this awful place, the word Gehenna, was the name of a gully or ravine south of Jerusalem, where at one bad time in Jewish history, people had worshipped a god named Molech by sacrificing their children to him in fire. Diggings in Palestine have uncovered the remains of infant skeletons around those altars. Even the Jewish people tried it. But one of their great reformers got it stopped and saw to it that from then on, that valley would be used only as a constantly smoldering garbage dump. It had such a horrible connotation in Jewish memory that they first thought of it as the perfect place for burning the bodies of their enemies killed in battle. The very last verse in Isaiah says that one day when Jerusalem was rebuilt, the people who worshipped God there would go forth and look on the dead bodies of those who had rebelled against God, for their worm shall not die, their fire shall not be quenched. Now this is eternal insult to dead bodies, to corpses. It has nothing to do with punishment for spirits that have lived a life of wickedness. But by and by, no one knows exactly how, the name of that always burning garbage dump got itself applied to a place of torment reserved for wicked people who were conscious after death. By the time of Christ, the idea of such a place was in everyone's mind. And by the time the book of Revelation was written, it was possible to paint a landscape where the wrath of God would punish unbelievers in fire and brimstone forever, with immortal worms adding to the general misery. We probably should notice certain clues that would keep us from taking all these things too literally. A literal worm is a real honest-to-goodness worm, would burn up in literal fire. So both metaphors are being used poetically. And literal fire would cancel out eternal darkness. So clearly we are in a world of symbolism. The fire standing for pain, the worm for the gnawing of remorse, and the darkness for isolation and loneliness. In Persia, modern Iran, where the Jewish people learned some of these things, there was a picture that was much the same. The human mind has always been remarkably creative in devising torment for others. And these people had planned for their wicked to be punished in a stream of molten metal. The whole concept has a complex history. One great Jewish rabbi declared that the torment of Gehenna lasts only for 12 months. But Philo, the Jewish philosopher, said just as emphatically that wicked Jews would be there forever. And devout men ever since have held different opinions. The great Catholic poet Dante pictured hell with ice at the very bottom instead of fire. But he did not mean it as an improvement. And he added some of the most hideous sound effects imaginable. By the time he was finished, people could draw a map of hell and locate the proper circle of punishment for every kind of human mistake. In the 17th century, the Protestant poet Milton added his intriguing contribution to hell's long history. It was a terrifying place, as he sketched it, but he gave it some rather curious comforts. The fallen angels built a parliamentary hall for debate. I think John Milton could not even have imagined hell without public argument. They play games, listen to music, and even sit around in small groups discussing theological problems. The point is that both men, Dante and Milton, working from a base of devout Christianity, redefined the landscape and the meaning of hell. So it should come as no surprise that modern thinkers do the same thing. And it's obvious that most of them have relocated it, moving it from a place somewhere to an attitude existing inside the mind of man. A brilliant Catholic, G.K. Chesterton, defined hell as energy without joy. And the mystic Swedenborg may have put it in the briefest and most accurate capsule of all: self-love constitutes hell. Berdyaev, a Russian student of Christianity, defined it as the final inability to love. He says, it is not what God will do to me that is terrible, but what I will do to myself. The hell he believes in is one people enter here when they cannot forget themselves. Our modern mystic, Thomas Merton, thinks that hell is where no one has anything in common with anybody else, except the fact that they all hate one another and cannot get away from one another. I went to a cocktail party like that once. As you can see, most Christian thinkers of modern times have not been interested in talking of a place, a physical location to which people are sent after this life ends. They talk instead of a psychological reality, which may be endured here if one chooses. Hell to them is not the action of God upon some ignorant or crippled or even deliberately disobedient soul. It is the absence of any action of God upon the personality at all. I've used the word modern, but the truth is that different views of hell are not modern at all. Clear back in the 3rd century, one of the most famous of all the Christian church fathers questioned whether hell was a place of physical fire and whether it lasted forever. That notion of eternity has seemed hard to square with our sense of justice and fair play. And the Russian theologian I mentioned earlier thinks that while hell is revealed to us in our own experience, it is quite a different matter to believe in a never-ending literal hell hereafter. There is something hideous and morally revolting, he says, in the idea of eternal torment as a just retribution for the crimes and sins of a brief moment of life. He calls that one of the most disgusting of human nightmares. But not many would have listened to that kind of comment in the churches of colonial America, the ones that looked so much like this, when Jonathan Edwards, son of a good congregational minister, preached the terrors of hell as few men have ever preached them. Although he and his wife brought 12 children of their own into the world, or perhaps because of it, he believed in frightening them as much as adults. As innocent as young children seem to be to us, he said, yet if they are out of Christ, they are in God's sight young vipers and infinitely more hateful than vipers. There is a sick mind. His famous sermon called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God was so terrifying that it touched off a wave of suicides in New England. He spoke of unconverted sinners walking in this life over the pit of hell on a rotten covering, so flimsy and weak that at any moment they might tumble through and land in the flames. The devil is waiting for them, he said. Hell is gaping for them. The flames gather and flash about them. And the God that holds you over the pit of hell, much as one might hold a spider or some loathsome insect over the fire, abhors you. It is hard not to feel a moment of relief when we read that his congregation finally had enough of that and dismissed him from service by an overwhelming vote. He became, predictably, a missionary. To the Housatonic Indians, poor devils, who have left no record of their reaction to his nightmare theology. I think he would have loved a Shell Oil sign I saw one night on the highway. The first letter had burned out, so that glowing in the darkness were the red letters, "Hell, open 24 hours." Jonathan Edwards and some preachers I have known rejoice at that thought, but the world of mainline Christianity no longer attempts to frighten people into faith and goodness by fire and brimstone sermons. And for that, I think, we can be grateful. But I remind you of something. The components of hell are all a reality. Ask the hostages of that 747. Ask the mother of a murdered child. Ask the guilty man hiding somewhere in the city, terrified of discovery. There is reason enough for us to create a community of love in this place and to care about it.